commandments. Cha, also.
Shastram, scripture. Panchala, panchala. Sangitam is described as Pitrihanam, going to Pitriloka. Devayanam, going to Devaloka. Shrotrat, by hearing. Shutatarat, by the companion named Shutadhara. Brajat, one can be elevated. So, translation, Narada Muni continued, the city spoken of as Dakshina Panchala represents the scriptures meant for directing pravritti, the process of sense enjoyment and fruitive activities. The other city named Uttara Panchala represents the scriptures meant for decreasing fruitive activities and increasing knowledge. The living entity receives different kinds of knowledge by means of two ears, and some living entities are promoted to Pitriloka and some to Devaloka. All this is made possible by the two ears. So what I'm going to do is read the previous verse, because we got the whole thing out of order today, and then we'll go on to the purport of that verse, the second verse that we read today. So text 12 was, Apano vyavaharutra chitramando bahunanam pitrihurnachina karna utaro devahu smritaha. The city called Apana represents engagement of the tongue in speech, and bahunana is the variety of foodstuffs. The right ear is called the gate of pitrihu, and the left ear is called the gate of devahu. Good. Just so I remember that. And so, purported by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Kijaya. The Vedas are known as Shruti, and the knowledge received from them through oral reception is called Shruti Dhara. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, one can be promoted to the planets of the demigods, or to the planets of the Vedas, the forefathers, or even the Vaikuntha planets, simply through the process of hearing. These things have already been explained in previous chapters. Alright, so So the Vedic literatures are one of several different branches of understanding knowledge in India. Of course, they're the perfect branch, and whatever one wants to achieve is sometimes called the desire through the Vedic literatures. One can approach the Vedic literatures for, if you want a sense gratification, if you want even justification of eating meat, or if you want to go to the heavenly planets as described here, if you want to go to hell, I mean, who wants to go to hell? Or if you want to go back to Godhead or anything. Pitriloka, of course, is like a heavenly planet, but it's a temporary heavenly planet. That's a vacation spot for your ancestors, just so you understand what it is. What it is that when you die, or one of your relatives dies, then their children, or your children, or sometimes even your disciples, or people who like you, will perform this process called pinda to keep you on vacation. And therefore, the son in the Vedic conception is called putra, which means someone who saves you from put or hell. So, Pitriloka, the very interesting story that I told, maybe I haven't told it here, but it's about, it's from the Mahabharata about Pitriloka and the duties of a son in keeping their parents from going to hell. Because we don't have to worry about that. So, Once upon a time, there was this one sage. He was actually a nice brahmachari. His name was Jatukarna, and he was very determined to be a good brahmachari. So while he was going through the forest, chanting Hari Bol, I'm free from all encumbrances in this world, he comes across a bunch of people hanging upside down. Thank you. Hanging upside down over a hole, and there's a rope holding them from dropping into the hole, and there's a rat eating the rope. And he thinks, this is really strange. So he asks them, why are you here? Somehow or other, he doesn't save them, but anyway. obviously, if I saw some people hanging upside down over a hole, I'd probably figure out call some friends and, we'd save them and pull them out. But anyway, it's a metaphorical story. So they're hanging, so he asked them, why are you doing that? And they said, well, because we're on our way to hell. And the reason we're on our way to hell is because our descendants has not actually performed pinda, which means keeping us out of hell. That's the payment for vacation in Pitriloka, the pinda. So he said, really, that's bad. Who's the name of this guy? And they said, his name is Jatukarna. And he said, it's my name. And he said, and they said, yes, this person, Jatukarna, not knowing that they were referring to the same person who was talking to them, has refused to get married. And therefore, he's not going to have any children to perform this pinda. And Jatukarna said at that point, he says, oh, damn it, he said, now I'm going to have to get married. So, what happened is that he said, all right, I'll make a deal. I'll get married only if I find a wife with the same name as me. That's like, agreeing to something but not agreeing to something simultaneously. All right. And he said, only if that happens. And also, if I find a wife with the same name as me, if she talks back one time, I'm leaving. So this is a pre-nuptial agreement. Even before you meet the lady, So he's wandering in the forest, and he says, well, I made a good deal there. So finally he says, he yells out, this is the last chance, if anybody or anybody who knows a girl with the same name, speak now or forever hold your peace. And unfortunately for him, or fortunately, this nice snake man, Vasuki, comes out, and he has a sister by the same name. And he says, actually, I have a sister. And you can get married to her. And of course, this sage, Jatukarna, says, oh my God, now what I am in for? Oh. And he says, all right, I'll get married to her. But then he remembers the pre nuptial agreement or statement he made before. He said, only if she doesn't talk back, ever. And they said, all right. So they get married very, very nicely. And she's very careful not to talk back to her husband. All you ladies who are married to women are sorry. We're going to have a training. Yeah, that's one of the things we talked about last night, so the ladies will never talk back to their husbands. So, that's one of the things that's impossible. So anyway, so what happened? It's like, easier to go back to Godhead. So what happened is that for this lady, she was very determined. But one time, he had to perform his Brahminical activities. Brahmins have to do this sandhya stuff. That means the three sandhyas, the three times of the day, morning, noon, and evening, they have to do their different sacrifices, to the sun or whatever. This is Brahminical activity. And he was sleeping, taking a nap. And it's not auspicious to sleep during the sandhyas. Just like we know that if a devotee sleeps during the Brahma Muhurta, it's very inauspicious. Actually, because he may be attacked by ghosts or demons. So you're not supposed to sleep during those sanjas. That's actually a rule. I mean, if you have to sleep, you can sleep the rest of the day, but not during the sanjas. So anyway, he took a nap. He didn't get up. He wasn't going to get up. And his wife said, was thinking, what am I going to do? You know, if I wake him up, I'm displeasing him, and he's going to leave. And if I don't wake him up, he's going to be upset because I didn't wake him up. So this is called a conflict. You know, a lose-lose type of conflict. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. So what happened? She decided, you know, out of her chastity to wake him up, because it's her duty. So she said, dear sweetie, please wake up. And he got angry. He said, you said you weren't going to talk back to me or give me instruction or anything like that. I'm leaving. And she said, I'm just doing it for your benefit. He said, I don't care. He was looking for an excuse. I mean, sometimes you look for an excuse to do something. So he's looking for an excuse, so he left. And she said, but I'm supposed to have a kid, because actually their kid was supposed to save all the snakes. Because Maharaj Janavijaya was performing this Sarpo Yajna to kill all the snakes, because, you know, his father had been killed, Maharaj Pritch had been killed by a snake, Takshika. So, Vishdhatu Karna said, that's all right. He said, there will be a kid. Ashtika was the word in Sanskrit. So that was the name of the kid. Anyway, so that was a story how someone got entangled to want to do pinda. We don't have to worry about that. First of all, we're not interested in going to Pitriloka. We're not interested in going to Devaloka. We're not interested in going to Marchaloka, the earth planet. We're not interested in going to the hellish planet. We're interested actually in serving Krishna wherever he sends us. Narayana Parakrave, Nakutasjana Vibhiti, Swarga Pravarga, Nadakeshu, Rapikulyarjadarshana. That's an interesting statement. That glorifies the devotees of the Lord. It says the topmost devotee of Narayana Parayana, he doesn't care whether he's in heaven, hell, or back to God. It's all the same to him. Swarga, Apavarga, Nadakeshu. Swarga means heaven. Apavarga means liberation. Nadakeshu means hell. Apituliyar to Darshana. He sees all those things completely equally, because wherever he goes, he's doing the same thing. He's serving Krishna. That's the benefit of being Krishna conscious. That wherever you go, it's the same thing. Just like I'm traveling around the world, wherever I go, it's Mangalarti. Same thing. And Tulsi worship, chanting japa. So it's no change. It's actually the same thing. You stick to the schedule. Nice, isn't it? And then by the process of devotional service, one gets a taste for these things. In the beginning, you do it because you're supposed to do it. But then after a while, you get addicted. Just like non-devotees will get addicted to different things. There's food addiction. There's alcohol addiction, there's drug addiction, and that's why they have all these anonymous clubs. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Surfers Anonymous. You know, I'm surfing the internet, but even surfing with the water. So we also have, you know, Chanters Anonymous, you know, we get together and say, I'm addicted to chanting, what am I going to do? Because we go to our parents, they'll say, you better stop. And so, it's like that. I mean, we develop an addiction to doing these things. It's like, you know, I guess I'm addicted to Mangalarti. It's just nice. It's part of life. It's like breathing, isn't it? That's how one should be with the sadhana. It's just like breathing. You know, there's no question of thinking, should I or shouldn't I? Am I tired? Am I hungry? Am I upset? Am I depressed? It's just like, you don't think if you're going to breathe. At least most of us don't think that. Right? I mean, when you wake up in the morning, do you think, should I breathe today? I don't feel like breathing. No, I mean, it's automatic. You just breathe. And you chant. So that's the process of bhakti. It sets the habits. And of course, while one's young, it's good to set good habits. Like Prabhupada said, he was asked, this was in Gainesville, Florida. I was with Prabhupada, and a reporter asked Prabhupada, why are there so many young people here? And Prabhupada, instead of answering directly, he said, yeah, so what is the age for education? And the lady said, I mean, sometimes you can get an old person going to university or something. And the girl said, well, when one's young. And Prabhupada said, yes, because you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So our habits should be set while we're young. Unfortunately, you don't have some good training, because that's the brahmachari training, or brahmacharini training. What is it? Brahmachari guru kule vasandanta gurovatam. That we should live in the ashram of a spiritual master and get trained up like that. Gurorhitam, to work for the benefit of the spiritual master. Just like talking about going to Mangalarti. First you go to Mangalarti to please your spiritual master. I mean, it's just obvious. Because you have the instruction. And then after a while, you do get a taste of the Gurorhitam. Archyam, Gatsavan, Nijo. A good behavior. Dasavan, understanding you're a servant. I mean, all these things are basic training in Krishna consciousness. That many of us who lived in the ashram, of course, many of you have never lived in the ashram here. So how do you get that training? That's a difficult thing, isn't it? I guess your wife trained you up that way. So anyways, not really, I'm just teasing. So one has to somehow or other imbibe that particular spirit that I'm a servant, good behavior, pleasing the spiritual master. Understanding the spiritual master is your friend, even though he tells you to do things that you'd rather not do. He's your ultimate friend, not like your ultimate friend. So in this way, you know, one has this training that sets good habits so that later on in life those good habits carry you through no matter what ashram or situation you're in. That's basic training. So anyway, so this is one point I wanted to speak about in regard to this particular verse. Another point is about the Vedas, which is what Srila Prabhupada talks about in the third book. That in India, you have these different darshans, and the Vedas are connected with sun. Darshan means like way of seeing things, basically. The darshan means to see. So a way of understanding things. So the Vedas are connected with some of those, but in India, there's other darshans, and I'm not saying that these are bona fide or good or anything like that, but these are just the prominent, prevalent ways of different understanding things. And so I'm going to explain somewhat of some of these different darshans or ways of understanding, and end with describing the Vedas. Because the Vedas are variegated, and there's different ways to even understand the Vedas. So one way that people have understanding things is like through logic. This is called nyaya, actually. Logic and understanding. You think that you become liberated just by being logical, which doesn't make sense to me. Because talking about epistemology, you can be extremely logical, but unfortunately, if your original axiom is off, then no matter how much good logic you have, you're going to come up with an improper conclusion. What I mean by that is, let's say you have mathematics, and you have a whole series of calculations, but if your original figures are wrong, even your calculations may be great, fantastic, valid, but you're going to come up with an improper result. Because everything is determined by the first step you take, or what's called an axiom. Axiom means a self-evident truth. You know, like, for example, in logic, sometimes you have self-evident truths, like things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. I mean, how can you prove that? If something's equal, it's equal, by definition. So you can't, like, prove any sort of axiom. Anyway. So, using logic to arrive at a particular conclusion, you have to start with some axiom or some, you know, self-evident truth. So if your self-evident truth is not coming from Krishna, even if your logic is perfect, or if your self-evident truth is imperfect, your conclusion will always be imperfect, no matter how much logic you apply to it. So that's one of the darshans there. Another one is very similar to modern science called Vaisheshika. Vaisheshika, actually. Vaisheshika. Which means, like atomism, you know, modern science. It's actually very similar to some types of Buddhism, where they say that everything's just atoms, or everything's happening by chance, basically, by the interaction of the material energy. And so, because in India, philosophy is quite highly developed. It's not like in the West that people are talking philosophy all the time. I mean, it's not that if you go out in the street that you'll run into philosophers, generally. Generally, you just run into people who are drunk, run into Sanskrit speakers. But India is based on, you know, the search for knowledge. And so they have different varieties of looking for knowledge. Another type of looking for knowledge is what's called Samkhya. Sankhya means basically to count. The word means to count. In other words, to analyze the material world in terms of its constituent elements. And of course, in traditional Sankhya, it was earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego, the senses, the senses and the sense objects, and then ultimately, you come to the three modes of nature. And sometimes, if it's atheistic, you don't come to the soul. But if it's theistic, you come to the soul. So that. Sankhya. Another type is yoga. Another type of understanding is yoga, headed up by someone named Patanjali, who was the author of Yoga Shastras. And he was rather theistic too, because he advised, first of all, you got to control your mind, control the senses, and then ultimately you got to worship God when you control the senses. Of course, he doesn't get into detail of who God is. So that's, those are the four, I just described four understandings that don't really follow the Vedas. But as far as those who follow the Vedas, there are several different understandings. There's the Mimamsa understanding. Mimamsa means, like karma Mimamsa, that if you do everything nicely, then you get a nice result. In other words, everything's karma. If you act nicely, you get a nice result. It doesn't matter if they're demigods, they just have to give you the good result. Even if God exists, it doesn't matter. He's also under karma. That's called karma mimamsa. And then, that's from the Vedas. You know, because karma, determining what is good karma, what is bad karma, is based on Vedic injunctions. And then, higher than that is something called uttara mimamsa, which means one of two things. Vedanta, impersonal Vedanta, or personalism, which we teach in Krishna consciousness. So these are the different types of Vedic conclusions, or what we call Vedanta understandings, or end, or goal of Vedic knowledge. And of course, we as devotees know the ultimate goal of Vedic knowledge is Vedais Chasavaya. Our homily for Vedio is to understand Krishna, is to be Krishna conscious. And so there's an interesting story that illustrates how personal understanding is more important, or is it more advanced than impersonal understanding. A story from the Jiva Dharma. That once upon a time, there was a sannyasi. And he was in Varanasi. Varanasi is a place of impersonalists. And this sannyasi was very advanced. He had actually achieved the stage of Paramahamsa. Pretty good, isn't it? Because there's different stages of sannyas. When you first take sannyas, it's Bohodak and then Gutichak. What that means is that it's hard to get detached in the beginning. So you have to have your wife send you food through your children. Because you can't figure out how to live without your wife cooking for you. Just recently I was talking to someone in India. I mean, it's hard to understand that, you know, but But you have to understand a little bit of Indian psychology. I was talking to one of my disciples whose wife left him. Yeah, for some reason or other. He's from India. Even divorce happens in India. So his wife left him, and his parents are arranging another marriage for him. And I said, why are you arranging another marriage? I mean, you're 50-something years old, you know, it's an age. And he said, well, my parents are worried I'm not going to be able to eat. And I said, if you like, I'll give you cooking classes. But they couldn't conceive how someone could eat if without a wife. I mean, that also indicates how the traditional Vedic family is, that the woman cooks and the man enjoys, and then somehow or other, you know, he just can't figure out how to light the fire, or, you know, or stir a sabji or something like that. It's almost like that story of like the Brahmin in his underwear, you know, who wanted to keep the rats from eating his underwear, so he got a cat, and then he had to get a cow, and then he had to get a wife, and finally he had to get a job, you know, just so he couldn't figure out how to keep rats away. So, so the first stage of sannyasis, because somehow in India, people are really attached to opulent cooking. And of course, we have some of that in the Krishna conscious movement, you know, that people are thinking, how can I live without a Sunday feast? Isn't it? I mean, people come to the temple on Sunday, and they don't go to the class, and they just come to eat. You ever have people like that here? You know, just thinking, you know, what is this? I mean, of course, when I first came to the Hare Krishna temple, I came just to eat, that's right. But I attended class because I thought that was my payment for the food that I had to sit through someone yelling at me that I was in Maya. So I'd be able to eat from Shana. Because that's how the classes were in the early days. You know, you just tell people, you're like a hog dog, camel asser, Kali Yuga's coming, you know, you're going to hell. Okay, when's for Shana? So, so the first stage is announced, you know, Bahubalpur, where the family, his wife actually still cooks for you. Your children, your son brings you the little tiffin. You know what tiffin is? Tiffin is like they have in India, you know, like the little stainless steel things or whatever. And then you say, wow, that's nice. Then after a while, you figure, do I really need this anymore? Maybe there's food available elsewhere. So then, you're still thinking of food. So the next stage is like Madhukari, and then you're going to everyone's house like a bumblebee, a bee, you know, and say, do you have a chapati? Can I have a piece of pizza? You're only supposed to take one piece of pizza from each house, you know. So you have Madhukari, you go to different people's houses, you're still thinking about eating. And then Parvajatacharya is a little higher, because then you're just wandering around and understanding, no, Krishna's going to provide for me. It's not going to be a problem. And you're wandering around preaching. And then Paramahamsa is where you just stay in one place. And, of course, there's no concern with food. You just stay in one place and chant Hare Krishna, and you're very happy, or absorbed in Brahman if you have to be in person. So getting back to the story. So this person had achieved the highest stage of Mayavadi sannyasa, you know, Paramahamsa, he was just in one place. But he wasn't happy. He was thinking, I've done all this thing, you know, I took sannyasa like 20 years ago, and I'm still waiting for the bliss to come. You know, I'm not interested in eating anymore, because it's Paramahamsa. I'm not interested in dress, you know, people appreciating me. I'm not interested in any of that. But where's the bliss? And he's just miserable like that. And so then one day he was meditating in Varanasi. Om, om, om. And then some devotee happens to walk by. Hare Krishna, Vitae Gauranga, Vitae Gauranga. And all of a sudden, just by the devotee being nearby, that's called burned up or a dried up ecstasy. It's a reflection of Baba. The devotee walks by and says, wow, I'm feeling bliss. What's happening? And then the devotee just walks by and then, and he's chanting, Goranga, Goranga. And then he doesn't, you know, somehow or other he's a little attached to his mind, body understanding, so he doesn't run after the devotee at that point, but then after his mind is running after the devotee. So he thinks, you know, how can I find the devotee? And then he goes all around Varanasi, where's this devotee? The devotee doesn't show up. But then he remembers the devotee was talking about a place called Navadvipa. And so, based on that little association with the devotee, he heads to Navadvipa. And he still maintains his ekadanda with him, you know, and Mayavadi sannyasa and all that. And then he seeks the association of one of the great devotees. His name is Paramahamsa Babaji. He seeks the association of him. And then, you know, to make a long story short, he actually eventually throws away his danda and everything he's proud of. Because the last thing he had, even though he's a Paramahamsa, he was very proud of his high position, high birth, big danda, everything like that. And he's Vaishnava, and his name becomes Vaishnava Das. And then he uses his previous learning in Vedanta to defend Vaishnavism. So it's a very nice story. So there's so many stories. Of course, this is actually mentioned in the Atmarama verse of the Bhagavatam, Atmarama's child, Vidantati, Rukamai, Kurvati, Haritiki, Bhakti, Tambhuta, Gunahari. That even those who are self-situated, Atmarama, Bhagavatam, Bhagavatam, Mahamsa, they're attracted to the quality of names and forms of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's the highest understanding, the highest Vedic understanding. And anyway, we are not interested in going to Pitri Loka, or any of these other lokas. We are interested in serving Krishna. Manmani, Bhagavad Bhakti Ahoyitaki Twaya, Janmani, Janmani, Shrile, Bhagavad Bhakti Ahoyitaki Twaya. Birth after birth, serving Krishna. So, any questions or comments? Yeah. He. Which he? And, oh, I didn't see it. I got the Brahma Jyoti in front of me, so it's hard to see it. Yeah.
Sir, interesting in Pitri Loka, but we have Pitris there, we have to do Pinda, you know.
No, they don't do Pinda in Pitri Loka. We do Pinda to keep them there.
Do we have to do
No, because if you're Krishna conscious, you're liberating all your descendants, all your ancestors, you know, forward, backwards, horizontally. I'll explain what I mean by horizontal. Horizontal means cousins, you know, people at the same level who are alive right now, like cousins, aunts, uncles, all those people. That's a horizontal liberation. Vertical means the future and the past. So you've got a horizontal, then the blessings you're giving, and vertical blessings you're giving. You know, sometimes it's mentioned 11 generations. I've heard different statements, 11 generations, 10 generations, 100 generations. But whatever it is, they're all getting benefit. So you don't have to do that, no. I don't do that. I mean, I have friends who do that. I mean, from India, they do this pinda, like once a year, they do this whole ceremony, and they're supposed to feed. Even Advaita Acharya did it. And he fed Haridas Thakur, who's supposed to feed the best of the Brahmins. So he's following the culture. Sometimes, because we're in a particular culture, we don't want to disturb people's minds, and we act in a certain way. For example, like you're here in the West and, you know, someone puts his hand out to shake your hand, you shake his hand. You don't say, you're a karmi, I'm not supposed to touch you. You shake their hand. Or nowadays in America, we don't shake hands anymore, we do fist bumps. You heard of that before? Yeah. And then after that, you do exploding fist bumps. or, you know, anyway, there's different cultures. You know, I remember when I was young, we had these special types of shaking hands where you go like this, this. But we, you know, if you're in a particular culture, you do things that are culturally acceptable so people won't criticize you. Even though as a Vaishnava, you don't really have to do those things. But you don't want to disturb people's minds. I mean, at least if you... A sannyasi doesn't have to do any of those things. But if you're in a grahastha ashram, you follow the rules of your ashram. You know, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about that. If you're a Brahmin, you need to do some of the Brahminical things. If you're a sannyasi, then you don't have to do those things. It's liberation. We don't have to do anything. So, that's pretty good. Sannyasa is pretty good. You got other people who cook for you. Previously, you know, if you were married, you just had your wife cook for you. But when you get become a sannyasa, everybody cooks for you. Everyone does your laundry. I mean, it's better than being home with your mother. Sometimes I tell the story that when I was young, I would throw my clothes and my mother would have to pick them up and do it. So now when I'm a sannyasa, I do the same thing. Throw my clothes when they're dirty and then some, they magically disappear and get come back the next day all out. Of course, a joking aside, if a sannyasi or anyone becomes dependent on others, it's actually not good. One of the qualities of someone, most important, someone who renounces has to be self-dependent or self-sufficient. In other words, not dependent. You know, if someone doesn't do the clothes, they have to be ready to do their own clothes. The clothes just pile up. You visit the sannyasi after a month and the clothes are up there. And he hasn't eaten, he's dying, you know. So, all right, so any other questions, yeah?
I'm a little confused about this charity and marriage because clothes, like Srimad Bhagavatam in Gita, Prabhupada said that poverty is actually sense gratification and liberty is renunciation, which
yes.
Is all of the liberty. But in Nectar of Devotion, according to Anyam Lashita Shinam verse, it's opposite, because like Yanakamadi and Navratam are actually poverty and
Anakamadi. Yeah, well, like I said, context defines a word. Poverty, in the Bhagavad Gita, poverty means what is to be done, Nivritti means what is not to be done. Praptim cha, nivritim cha, jnana, vidur, osara. Everybody knows that verse? The demons don't know what is to be done, what is proper, what is not proper. So in that particular context, praptim means what is the right thing to do. And nivritti means what is not to be done. So in this particular context, it means, praptim means the process of sense adjournment. Words just are defined according to context.
Very opposite.
Yeah. Pravati means the positive thing, but in this context, see the context is, pravati actually means the positive thing to achieve something, but the context of what we're discussing here is sense gratification.
Yeah.
No. You see, here we're discussing, this whole part of the Bhagavatam is discussing sense gratification using the nine gates of the body. So if you want sense gratification, let's go. So, and if I'm discussing Krishna consciousness, then what is to be done will be, you know, bhakti, you know, inviting bhakti, sadhana bhakti, whatever. That's all. It's just that what you should do, in other words, pravartin means positive injunctions to do something. To do something. Not necessarily sense of humor, not necessarily devotional service. So in the context, if I say, we want to become devotees, now here is what should be done. Or, if I say, now we want to enjoy our senses, here is what's to be done. So it's usually the same expression, but it indicates different things according to the context. And nivritti, of course, means what is not to be done. So if I say, I want to enjoy my senses. So the nivritti is to not join the Hare Krishna movement. You understand what is not to be done. Don't associate with the devotees. Don't hear about the negativity of the material world. Just like when I joined the movement, I told my brother, I said, I'd like to tell you about Krishna consciousness. He said, don't talk to me about it. You'll spoil it. Spoil my life. And of course, he said, ignorance is bliss. I said, at least you understand that. At least you understand you're in ignorance. So, you know, nivritti can mean what is not to be done. Basically, means what is not to be done. Pravritti cha and nivritti cha. So in the context of the Bhagavad Gita verse, it means in accordance with Vedic injunctions or karma and vikarma, pravatim cha, nivritim cha, that the demons don't know what is to be done, what is not to be done. In other words, they act in the opposite way usually. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Just, you know, any expression, you know. There's positive injunctions for demons and positive injunctions for devotees. You know, please give me instruction how to be a demon. Okay, I'll tell you. Go out and eat meat, fish, and eggs. Go to the bar. I can give you some more instructions later if you're interested. And if you want to be a devotee, you know, wake up early, chant 16 rounds, follow 4 regulated principles. Associate with devotees, worship Panchatattva, eat prasadam. Like these things. All right. So, any other questions or comments? Yes.
You said that from Vedic knowledge we can get a lot of knowledge. We have also Ayurveda, but devotees more believe some new theory on internet.
New theories of Ayurveda? What?
No, new theories. Like
karmis,
every year there's some new.
Yeah, Krishna says Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nish Trigunya Babarjana Nirvan Dwar Nitrasatva So Yogi Shem Abnavan. The Vedas are mainly dealing with the three modes of material nature. And he says to Arjuna, you're meant to be Krishna conscious, so don't bother with these things. And also, as far as the knowledge, the original knowledge, the Vedic knowledge, most of it right now has not survived in its original form because it hasn't been passed down in disciplic succession. I mentioned this the other day when we were talking about the Dashamula, that most of the Vedic literature, most of the Puranas have not been passed down in disciplic succession, therefore they've been changed. Even the Mahabharata's been changed. Now, I read the Mahabharata, I like the stories in the Mahabharata, but I don't take it with the same, you know, the same level of authenticity as I do the Bhagavatam. Sri Padmavacharya said the Mahabharata has actually been changed. Things added, things taken away, or things changed within the Mahabharata. There's roughly 84 different versions of the Mahabharata according to what part of India you're from. And a number of years ago, scholars tried to come up with the critical edition of the Mahabharata, means the original edition. They weren't able to, you know, Western intelligence scholars. And the stories differ. I mean, the main story is the same. You know, there's the Pandavas, there's the Kurus, and there's the war. But, you know, some of the details are different. And one example I give is Satyavati, who has a child by Parashara Muni, because that's Vyasadeva. In the northern edition of the Mahabharata, it happens on an island in a river. You know, he just like says to her, you know, I'd like to have a kid. And she said, well, not a good idea. All the sages around, it creates a fog. There's a big fog. And also she gets the benediction of smelling nicely. Because before that, when she was the fisherman's daughter, she smelled like a fish market. That's true. I mean, that's a story in the northern edition. Because she was born from a fish, according to the northern edition. And, you know, when you're born from a fish, you're going to smell like a fish. So when she got a benediction from Parashara Muni, then she was called Ganda Yojana after that, which means for 8 miles, she smelled so good she didn't need perfume, that people would faint. So that's the northern. And the southern edition, you have Parashara Muni meeting her, and they have a regular marriage ceremony, you know, with the swaha business. You know, Farzagavai, Swaha, and all the Brahmanas blessing them and everything like that. Because in South India, they're much more traditional than North India. So you have these differences. So how do you reconcile? And sometimes you have the differences of the Mahabharata story from stories from the Bhagavatam. How do you reconcile them? The reason, the way we reconcile them is the Mahabharata has been changed, and Madhvacharya says that. So we only accept the Vedic literatures that come down in unbroken chain of disciplic succession. And you know, I know nowadays devotees get so much into Ayurveda and astrology. You know, this is my Saturn period, Prabhu, don't wake me up for Mangalarti. You know, in 3 years I'll be, you know, my Jupiter period, I'll be a really good devotee. And, you know, but right now, you understand what's happening. Be compassionate with me. So, you know, they get too much into these things. Like Prabhupada said, by the chanting of the holy names, that Krishna can destroy millions of Rahus with the tip of the toe of his feet. So we're not interested. I mean, Prabhupada even accepted Western medicine when he was dealing. He took Ayurvedic stuff too, that's right. But the reason Prabhupada exercised every day was because some Western doctor told him to do it. Not an Ayurvedic doctor, not a yoga practitioner. But a Western doctor told him to do it, an aerobic walk every day. You know, people wonder why Prabhupada walked so fast. That was the doctor's advice. After he had a heart attack in New York. So Prabhupada was, whatever works. He wasn't into this, oh, there's Ayurveda or Western. You know, whatever works. Prabhupada's utility is the principle. Prabhupada wasn't. And Prabhupada didn't get into all these different rituals and mudras and mantras and everything. Everything was very simple. Chant Hare Krishna and be happy. And that's our movement. And we don't want to get too complex about things, you know. And sometimes people in India, they criticize Prabhupada. Well, he shouldn't have done like this. He shouldn't have given carrots to the devotees. Because carrots are supposed to be the bones and blood of sages. You ever hear this before? They say, no carrots. But Prabhupada, he loved carrots. He would make carrot halwa, you know, for the devotees on the Kadashi. So we just don't want to make our lives too complex. We accept things the way Prabhupada presented things. I mean, just right now there's actually a little controversy going on, because Prabhupada, many times in his books and his letters and everything, said that Advaitacharya has a beard. And then you have some people in the Gaudiya Mouth saying, but we heard that Advaitacharya doesn't have a beard. And so there's this whole beard controversy right now. Does he have a beard? Does he have a beard? And some devotees say, well, if we want to fit in with the Gaudiya Mouth, we have to take the beard off of Advaitacharya. But the point isn't the beard. The point is that Prabhupada. You know, Prabhupada said something, it's good enough for me. And Prabhupada had his reasons for saying things. I don't need to jump over Prabhupada's heads and research the previous acharyas. Prabhupada said, we came from the spiritual world, that's good enough for me. And of course, in my readings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books, I find that Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the same thing. That we came from the spiritual world. Krishna Bharahi Mukh, we turned our face away from Krishna. So that's the faithfulness of a disciple. He doesn't jump over the head of the spiritual master and think, you know, I know better, you know, because I can find out what your guru said. You know, ultimately we were faithful to Prabhupada. So, any questions, other questions or comments? Yes. Yeah. Karma Mimamsa basically means the philosophy that Krishna would, that's called Purva Mimamsa is another name for it. It means the philosophy that Krishna was preaching to Nanda Maharaj and the residents of Vrindavan to convince them to stop worshipping Indra. And Prabhupada comments that it's a bogus philosophy. And many people in India follow this Karma Mimamsa philosophy too. That if you act nicely, if you do things nicely to get good karma, then you get a good result. And there's no God, and even if there is a God, he's controlled by his own karma. Or he has to give you the results according to your karma, even if the demigods are there. And Krishna presented that to Nanda Maharaj. He said, even if Indra exists, and he was just trying to agitate Indra, actually. He said, even if Indra exists, if you act nicely, he has to give you rain. You know, he's just working for the government. It's just like, I mean, just like if you want to get a driver's license here, you know, you don't really care about the person who's examining you for the driver. You know, of course, you should be nice to them. But it's not that you have to give them a bribe or anything. Because if you pass your test, you pass your test. So in the same way, if you act nicely, you'll get a good result. But they don't take into account that there's a superior person who's Krishna. And the demigods also, you can agitate them too, like Krishna did deliberately. So that's called Purva or Karma Mimamsa. Uttara Mimamsa, Uttara means higher or the highest. And that means taking the Vedas for spiritual understanding. In Purva Mimamsa, they take the Vedas for material enjoyment. And in Uttara Mimamsa, they take the Vedas for liberation, basically, or higher understanding. And so there's two types of Uttara Mimamsa. One is the impersonal Vedanta, you know, Mayavada philosophy. The other one is Krishna consciousness, or Vaishnavism. All right, one other question, otherwise we're going to end. Yes. Atmarama, yeah.
Yeah, but in the Atmarama verse, you have one verse, and basically it's like 80 possible understandings.
More than that, yeah.
Of each word, or even more.
Yeah.
So, how does one in this context?
That's why you need someone to give you the. That's why you need a guru, that's why you need someone who is a pure devotee who can present the proper understanding. Like Lord Chaitanya, of course, he came up with, like, I think, hundreds of different interpretations of the Atmarama verse. He thought Atmarama means someone who's taking pleasure in the self. It could also mean someone who is completely in the mode of ignorance. Or someone who's enjoying the body. I mean, it could mean different things like that, according to the context. Atma means self, but Atma can also mean body. It could also mean mind, according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Rama, of course, means enjoyment. So there's different ways to explain things, and that's why we need great expert devotees to explain these things to us. But the general meaning of that Atmarama verse is that even if people are self-situated, in other words, transcendentally situated, even in personal understanding, and the example, of course, is given as Sukadeva Goswami and the four Kumaras, they're still attracted to the quality names, forms, and pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like you have Shukadeva Goswami, who was in the womb of his mother for 16 years because he was afraid of coming out and getting into Maya. Like Prabhupada said, the problem with you Western boys and girls is you're not enough afraid of Maya. So we should follow the example of Shukadeva Goswami. Anyway, not exactly. He remained 16 years in his mother's womb, and his parents were kind of in anxiety. You know, 16 years is a long time, waiting for a kid to be born. And so, but when he heard the Bhagavatam, then he became attracted. This is the story. He became attracted and then left. He just was born, and then 1 second later, he took sannyas. Not in a formal way, he just ran away. He didn't even have time to put his clothes on. Right? He just ran away, completely naked, 16-year-old boy at that point. His father was thinking, I waited so long for him, and now he's just running away. Imagine, can you imagine parents, you know, they have a child, oh, my dear little child, the first thing the child does is he runs away from home. Kind of frustrating. And so Shukadeva Goswami was being chased by his father, Vyasadeva. And his father was saying, oh my son, oh my son. And it's described that Shukadeva Goswami didn't even say, you know, goodbye to him. Because it's described that the only response that Vyasadeva got was that the echo, oh my son, and then the echo from the trees and the mountains, oh my son, oh my son, oh my son. Not even a goodbye. I mean, it's like Lord Jesus Christ said, you know, let the dead bury the dead. And anyone who looks back can't enter the kingdom of God. Same sort of thing. So this is an interesting thing. And of course, then Shukadeva Goswami thought, you know, I got to get this father off my back. So he created, using his mystic powers, a duplicate of himself, a clone. So cloning has been going on since time immemorial. So the story's there in the Bhagavatam. I'm not just making this up. He created a duplicate, because Prabhupada talks about this when he talks about the dynasties. And he said there's a dynasty from Shuka, and he said that's a different Shuka, So anyway, so he created a clone that his father could take back with him. So his father would be happy. Just like nowadays in Japan, people have a great need of love, so they have these robots now. True. They get robot dogs even now. And the latest thing is, you know, you get a robot wife. And she definitely doesn't talk back. So anyway, I'm not speaking about these things. All right, so time for Prasanna, because we're not on the platform of Paramahansa yet. So all glories to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti, Prabhupada.